The title of the talk this afternoon is Waking Up. So I'll start with a riddle. A Buddhist is dreaming that she's on a boat that's sinking. And after having helped everybody else to safety, she finds herself among the last three people on the boat. There's only herself and two other people, a woman and her teenage daughter, left alive on the boat. And there's only one very small raft left that can only hold two people. What should she do? What should she do? Now, some people, when I ask them this riddle, they think, well, she's got to give the raft to the other two people. And some people think, well, maybe she should just flip a coin and just decide that way. And other people just throw their hands up in the air and say, this is a real problem. But the answer, if you haven't figured it out already, is very simple. She just needs to wake up. She's dreaming. And for those of you who didn't get the answer and laughed, notice what it felt like in your body and in your mind when the answer, which is so simple, comes to you. That moment of recognition, of understanding, that moment when we go, ah, is something to pay attention to, both in our life and in our practice. Most of you know the story of the Buddha, and you know what the word Buddha means. It means one who is awake. That's how he described himself. When someone met him on the road after his great enlightenment, which can also be known or called the Great Awakening, which I personally prefer, when someone met him and was impressed by the Buddha's radiance and dignity and enormous spirit, the person asked him, are you a god? And the Buddha said, no. Are you some kind of magical being? No. Well, then what are you? And the Buddha just simply replied, I am awake. And that's what we're here to do, to follow in the Buddha's footsteps in a manner of speaking, to explore what it means to be awake in life. And I'm sure that most of you, if not all of you, have discovered the first great insight of insight meditation, which is that we don't seem to be awake very much of the time. That the mind can go here and there and everywhere, and we can feel as if we are wandering lost in a dream. It's not very pleasant to experience this for most of us. And yet, those moments that we have of recognition, of waking up, of realizing, where have I been, what have I been doing for the past 20 minutes, I'm supposed to be with the breath, are very important for us. Because they reveal to us the normal state, the usual state of our minds. People sometimes say, I don't like meditation. I come to this retreat and the meditation is making me go all over the place, is making my mind go crazy, wander all over the place. It's not the meditation that's making that happen. It's revealing this as the normal state that we usually spend time in. We're not even aware of it, though, most of the time. What are these dreams, these daydreams, these fantasies that we're lost in so much of the time? What are they all about? Would anybody like to volunteer to let us know? I'm told that there might be a machine that we could hook up with a person's brain. And it would be attached to a loudspeaker. And if you volunteer, you could sit here all day, and we can hear exactly what's going on in your mind. Would anybody like to do that? Suppose I guaranteed enlightenment at the end of that. Would anyone still like to volunteer? The mind has no shame. What it can throw up in front of us, the things that we can think about and get caught up in, it's extraordinary. But we're not alone, judging from the number of people who laugh. And this is one of the good things about having a sense of humor and ease about this practice. It is funny. It is a strange thing that we do here, walking slowly and sitting together in silence. But so much can be learned about that. This moment of recognition when we remember, oh, where have I been? Where am I? What happened to me? Oh, back to the breath, is very significant. And it is like that moment of release. It's almost physically as if we've been like this. Sometimes you can feel it in the body. Gone in some world somewhere, arguing with your spouse or whatever it might be. And then someone sneezes next to you and you remember, oh, and there's a relief, there's a release. Oh, yes, back to the breath. I'm glad I can come to the breath. It's like dropping a burden. It feels that way, as if the body releases something and relaxes. Almost everybody here has been very kind and concerned about my backpack. The backpack melodrama is over, I can tell you that. They delivered the backpack yesterday to me. And Christopher made a few funny remarks about it. He saw me carrying my small rucksack the other day and he says, oh, traveling lightly for a change, aren't you? Because he knows what my backpack is usually like. And some of you have been very kind. You've been offering me clothes. Some of you who are much taller than I and much wider than I. I wondered what I would look like with some of the clothes that have been offered to me. And I thank you. It was very touching to me to be offered. But here I am in my best kind of Malibu outfit, got with my clothing. This backpack image, just about every one of us knows this. We know what it feels like to carry a heavy weight on our backs. And many of us who've been to India know how difficult it is to be searching around a station platform for the right train and told it's on this platform, it's on that platform, no, it's coming this time, no, it's that time. All the time feeling the weight of all of those jars of peanut butter or whatever it is that we've got, digging into our shoulders like razor blades after a while. What does that feel like? Oh, can't wait until the Shatabdi Express arrives and I can get this off my back. And finally we get into the train, and you know what it's like getting into an Indian train with a big backpack. The door is that narrow to go through, and there are 15 people coming out as you're going in. And they're all carrying these little tiffins, you know, and meanwhile you've got everything stuck in the back of your backpack. Do you need some help? And you get to the seat, finally, and six people are sitting there. Two of them are asleep. On your bed, on your bunk. It says so. It says A4, number, berth number 12 over here. I know, but this is AS4. This is the wrong coach. So you have to get out. The train is whistling. You run down to the opposite end of the platform. It's always at the other end. To get the correct coach. and finally get into the train just as it starts to pull off. You do have to wake up three or four more people, including some screaming children, to get off of your seat. And finally, one shoulder strap comes off. The belt buckle comes out. The last shoulder strap is still digging into your shoulder. You turn around on the bunk and let it off. Oh, what does that feel like? What does that feel like? Everybody knows that feeling. It's a tremendous relief. It's a simple, direct experience that every one of us has had. And in my view, it is the essential teaching of liberation that the Buddha is talking about, is presenting to us. The happiness that comes from dropping a burden. A burden that is self-imposed. What would this burden be? What burden or burdens are we carrying with us? When we're lost in these fantasies and ideas and opinions and projections that Christopher spoke about yesterday, how burdensome can they be for us? It's often painfully obvious at the start of a retreat how much our self-image, our judgments, and our expectations torture us. We are tortured by them. So, for example, in the sitting and in the walking that you've done, in the day and a half, 2 days of practice that you've had, what expectations, what judgments have you burdened yourself with? Instructions are very simple. Sit, follow the breath, watch the mind, come back, walk, take a step, feel the contact. Okay, so I think I can do that. That doesn't sound like rocket science to me. So we sit down with every intention to follow the breath. It's not so easy. All of a sudden you realize, you know, I can't even follow two breaths in a row. I can't even follow one breath. I take one in-breath, one out-breath, and I am literally out to lunch, thinking about lunch. All right, I can do this again. I'll sit again, and I'm going to be completely aware of every single breath for 45 minutes. I know I can do it. How many times have we had that kind of expectation? Then the pain arises. Of course, it's our fault. Why can't I sit like somebody else who's not in pain? I'm sure that person isn't in pain. She's sitting like this with a smile and everything is great. Maybe it's because she's wearing that fantastic, you know, what outfit. The mind is going like this continuously. Okay, so we get to the walking. Let's see. Not too good at sitting, but I can do some walking. All right, I'll do walking practice. I'm going to go from A to B, and I'm going to be aware of every single step I take mindfully. Ever have a thought like that? So we take a step, take the step one. Absolutely there, I'm ready for enlightenment. Step two, I'm right with the step. Step, maybe between step three and four, something becomes so much more interesting than enlightenment. What might it be? Maybe it's getting out of the heat that we just walked into when we passed under the shade of the tree. I'd better turn around now. Maybe it's the smell of something coming from the kitchen. I think I'll take a break and just wander in there and see what they're doing. No, wait a minute. I've got to practice. I've got to be mindful. All right, I'll start over again. Go back to the beginning. Another step, another step. Again, the same thing happens. Another very common feeling in meditation is, if only I could sit without any thoughts, then I would be meditating. Thought is the enemy. Thought is the problem. I have to get rid of my thoughts. Did it ever occur to you that I have to get rid of my thoughts is another thought? Think about that. It's one thought at war with all the other ones. Another idea, expectation that we have is if we only could sit still, no matter what goes on, and I'm going to do it, I'm going to sit through any kind of pain, because I know that's what the Buddha did, right? Then I'll be able to really meditate. I'm going to sit perfectly still. I once went to a retreat. I went to a Goenka retreat in Nepal. You know, Goenkaji emphasizes very much, strong emphasis on sitting, strong discipline. Many people, very, very, very dedicated practitioners. I found it hard to do myself, but I thought it was very valuable. I went through the whole retreat. We got to the last day, the last morning, when we were allowed to speak. It was breakfast time. And a young fellow who was very, very excited was sitting next to me, staring at a stick insect that was about 3 feet away from us. If you've ever seen these stick insects, like a praying mantis or other, they're amazing. They can just stay there like this all day, waiting for something to go by that they can catch, or just hanging out perhaps, or perhaps they're meditating. This fellow kept looking as he was eating his breakfast, looking at the insect, and then leaned over to me. And I could tell he was new in practice. I felt that I had sat too many retreats at that point. I don't know. But in any case, I was less enthusiastic about this. But he said to me, "You see that insect? If only I could sit like that, I know I'd be enlightened." He said, "I know it. If I could just sit still like that, look at that. It's so perfect." Now I looked at him. I refrained from saying something that I felt I should say. It's working with my intention to speak. And I said instead, I said, "Well, it may be that you're projecting something a little bit onto that insect. It may not be what you think it is." And I was reminded of a quote by Ajahn Chah, a great Thai forest monk, great meditation master, the teacher of some of my teachers and some of your teachers. I was reminded of this quote by Ajahn Chah. He said, "People think that if you sit still, then you're really practicing. I've seen chickens sit on their nest for days without end." So whether it's having the expectation that we can sit and just follow one breath and the next breath for 45 minutes, take one step and the next step for 45 minutes, sit without any thoughts, sit and just sit still without any pain, what are we burdening ourselves with all of these ideas and expectations? We are at war with our own experience to some degree. There's a kind of perfectionism that we adopt when we get into meditation. We can adopt. Not all of us, but many of us have felt this. I know I have. And it reminds me of a story about a man who was looking for the perfect woman. And he went through one relationship after another. One woman wasn't pretty enough. One was too tall. One was not too smart, but not smart enough. One didn't have the same interest that he had. He kept going from one to the next to the next. Finally, I heard that he had found the perfect woman. So I was excited to hear the news. I ran over to him. I said, Bob, I heard you found a perfect woman. So he said, yeah. I said, what's the matter? What's wrong? Yeah, I found the perfect woman, all right. Well, what's the problem? She was looking for the perfect man. What's the alternative in our life to looking for perfection where it cannot be found? To putting our faith, our hope, and trust in a world of changing phenomena, of flux, of insubstantiality that we see from one moment to the next if we pay attention in our meditation and in our life. What would be another way to practice, another way to live? Perhaps we could think of our practice as just one breath, one half breath at a time, one step at a time. And if we fall asleep, if we lose connection, if we get lost, there's always another opportunity to wake up. The next moment, we can come back to the next step, the next breath. Wouldn't that be a more empowering way for us to practice, for us to live? How can we gain that kind of wisdom, that kind of understanding that allows us to relate to life in that way? This practice is called insight meditation. And some of you may be wondering by now, where are the insights? Except for the first one, which I told you about, that my mind is going all over the place. I didn't come here to learn that. I want to have some insights. What is an insight? If we think about it, there are two kinds of insights that I'm aware of. Perhaps there are more. We could perhaps divide insights into what we might call the worldly or ordinary or mundane insights and what we might call spiritual or perhaps deeply significant insights. An insight is a shift in perception of something that makes a difference for us. A simple example would be the riddle that I just told you. When you didn't know the answer and then you heard the answer, all of a sudden, it's so simple. I see into. And when we're puzzled by things, when things are confusing to us, when we don't see the answer, when we're tied up in knots, and an answer comes, an insight comes, it can be very liberating for us. Very freeing. It could be something so simple as this. If you look at this diagram, I'll tell you how long I spent drawing this, it would be embarrassing. If you see this, what you see here can be seen in two different ways. And if you look long enough at it, you'll see it shift from one to the other. It's an optical illusion. You can either see a vase in which you can put flowers at the top, or you can see two people face to face, two profiles. And again, if you see that, you see the figure and the ground reversing. And insights are like that. Similar kinds of insights are the kinds that you see in the optical illusions that pop out of the page. They pop out. And you're supposed to be able to see them by staring cross-eyed at them. I can never do this. It's very frustrating. I'm told that there's a therapy group in California for people who can't make the things pop out of the page. It's a shift for us. And sometimes it's deeply significant because we're able to see something that's always been there for the first time. Something that's so close to us that it's actually hidden. I think of insights the way I think of flowers. They grow, they come out of dirt, out of something you don't expect. My father was a photographer many years ago. He used to take pictures of flowers, and he told me very touchingly when he was dying, almost near his death, he remembered these photographs and he smiled and he said, I've never been able to understand how a flower like that comes out of this crummy, crappy dirt. And there's just a great smile lit up on his face. And I think of insights almost in that way, arising out of perhaps what we could call the manure of our minds or our experience, the dirt, the difficulties that we have. What would be the insights that would allow us to live more freely in life, with more happiness, with more ease? What are the conditions that would help to make these insights flower? Think of yourself as a kind of gardener here. If you know about gardening, what you do when you plant a seed, you take care, you do what you have to do, you dig the correct amount of earth away, you put in fertilizer, you take the weeds away, you water it, and you wait. You've done your part, the rest is up to the nature of things. When the conditions are right, with the right water and the sun and the other things that you have created, the seed sprouts, the flower comes. It's a simple analogy, and it has some value, I think, for us on retreat, because the retreat environment can be thought of as, in a way, providing the conditions for insight to arise in the mind. So in the silence, in the stillness, in the aloneness, which is not the same as being lonely, these conditions allow the mind to open more, to see more, to be more receptive. And in with this, the value of the discipline of the simple practice of sitting and walking and just showing up, just coming and doing the practice is extraordinary. And it can't be overestimated, I think, the value of taking an interest in things. It's such a good attitude to have. If we take a simple interest in things, even in things that we don't like, especially in things that we find difficult. So take boredom, for example. It's very common. And Christopher spoke about it yesterday. How much of our lives are devoted to avoiding this very unpleasant experience. But here, you can't do that. And I remember on my first retreat, I came to my teacher and I was very upset. I said, this is so boring, I can't stand it anymore, I'm going to die. One breath is the same as another. It's the same thing every day. We eat the same food. It's the same, it's the same, it's the same. I wanted him to help me, to relieve the boredom. He was a good teacher. He just pointed his finger at me and he says, be bored, he said. You think you're going to die of boredom? Good. He said, go back in the meditation hall and be the first yogi to die of boredom. Go ahead. We'll put your name up on the wall. I was shocked when I heard this, but it was such a good teaching for me because I did go back into the hall. I was bored. 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 And it went. It went. It didn't last. Oh, I'm not bored anymore. And the value of just staying with an experience of being willing to stay and to take an interest. What is boredom? What is this thing that I run from that's so difficult? It's extraordinary what a transformation can occur in the mind and the heart with that taking of interest. Through all of these conditions and the simplicity of the surroundings, insights can arise. What are these insights? What might we feel is an important insight for us that can wake us up out of this dream world that we're in? A dream world, a burdensome dream world of expectations and pressure. Here's a question for you. It's a simple question. Think about everything that you've experienced on this retreat so far. The glorious sunset that you saw sipping tea. The pain in your knee that made you feel you wanted to leave. The peace, the ease, the boredom, the restlessness, all of it. All of the mind states, all of the thoughts that you've had from the moment you entered the retreat until this moment. Can anybody show them to me? Where are they? What happened to them? This insight into how things don't last has to go very deep for us to really make a difference, so that it's not just a nice idea. Oh yes, I see that. I see the difference there. Isn't that interesting? But it's something that has the power to transform our lives. How can we make that insight, which is so obvious? It's not something that we project onto the world. It is the way that life reveals itself to us. It is one way in which life reveals itself to us. How can we make that insight go from here down to our bones, so that we can live with the understanding that all our experience is like a dream? It's not findable. And that we make it more real sometimes than it deserves to be, through the power of investing our interest in it, of holding on to it, of making something out of it that it doesn't actually have within itself. And this power of the mind to grasp hold of something and try to make it substantial, even though we know somewhere that it isn't really like that, this power can cause so many difficulties for us. Can we learn to relax that grip that we have on things? The grip that expectation and judgment really form in our minds. What are we here for? Sometimes it's necessary to ask ourselves, especially if we get bored and are feeling a lack of interest, why we came to this retreat in the first place. We hope, all of us, that we're here because we want to be here. To explore these teachings, to explore teachings about love, about awareness, about liberation, to make these words come alive for us so they're just not ideas. What does freedom really mean to us? And the Buddha, very practically minded, wasn't so interested in philosophical arguments about these words. He pointed to the direct freedom, the freedom that makes a difference, the freedom from suffering. It's freedom from suffering that we're exploring, not the freedom to do whatever pops into our heads. Sometimes people think freedom means just to follow along with whatever pops into our heads. But as I'm sure you've seen, what kind of a world would we have if we followed along with everything that went into our heads over the past couple of days? Sometimes these insights can be difficult, can be painful, and we can get a sense of disillusionment, or what we might call disenchantment. I like this word, because it means not being caught up, not being enchanted by our experience. Stepping back and asking ourselves, do I really have to make my happiness dependent on experiences that come and go that I seem to have no control over? And I think that when we get that sense of disenchantment with things, it's actually a good place to be, even though it doesn't feel good. That's a kind of deep insight for us, this sense that I can't really depend on my mind or my experiences to provide a lasting happiness for me. And when that happens, we might see the value of waking up out of this dream that we're in, that we find ourselves in. We might see the value of putting down the burdens that we carry. Can't change our experience. But the freedom that the Buddha is talking about has to do with looking at what we can change, the way that we relate to our experience, the way we react to things. Does the mind have to feel this grip, this running toward what's pleasant? Does it have to feel this pushing away of what's unpleasant? Can we learn to stay steady, to be with things, to take an interest, to open to things? We have that capacity already. We just need to practice that. Nothing I'm saying here is news, really. But it's just a reminder to all of us, all of us. When we can do that, when we can understand that the value, the power, and the joy of relaxing the grip on things is something fundamental for us, and maybe we'd be able to understand in a deep and significant way what the Buddha's teaching is about. In seeing a moment of release and appreciating it, noticing those moments in the day when we feel burdened by something and then all of a sudden there's a sense of relaxing, of dropping the mental constructions, of being willing to say, yes, I think I'll sit in a chair now and I'll challenge my ideas about sitting. Maybe I don't need to sit on the floor and suffer through pain. Maybe that's just an idea in my mind. Maybe I should look at my mind and see, gosh, sitting in a chair, that's not good for my self-image. Everybody else is on the floor. That's the burden. That's the thought. That's the menace for us. And the freedom that comes and the courage it takes to really challenge those thoughts and say, I'll do this. I will do this today. I will do this differently from what I expect, from what I want. I'll just do my practice in a quiet and disciplined way and see out of that soil what flowers of insight might come. If we can live more like that, if we can practice more like that, we might be able to understand one of the great teachers of Buddhist meditation, Dogen, who said something wonderful. He said, enlightenment is intimacy with all things. And to have a mind that's open, that's receptive, that's boundless, that's in touch with all things, is potentially possible for all of us. We can work with the boundaries of what we can tolerate, what we can accept, what we can open to. We can learn to be there and to discover freedom right at that boundary. It takes courage. It takes faith. It takes wisdom that we already have. And when we do that, more and more, when we practice that, something beautiful can happen to us. Life begins to live itself. And the separations between things and between us seem not so solid anymore, not so important. And we can come to rest more and more in something that holds everything. That holds everything without any effort. And in that understanding, tremendous love and compassion can arise spontaneously for ourselves and for others. As we see each of us really, really together, not so separate. And it's in that understanding, in that calmness of mind, in that openness, we can see everything reflected in everything else. As if we see infinity in a grain of sand. And then we have the deep understanding that nothing really blocks this freedom in life, that nothing is really apart from this wonder of everything arising and spontaneously coming and going. And the great joy that is possible for us when we realize that even the very causes of our suffering are open doorways to that liberation. That's what's possible for us by making the commitment again and again to wake up, to stay awake as much as we can, to take delight in being awake, to notice the difference between being lost and being aware. And through that commitment, great happiness and freedom is possible for each and every one of us. So let's just sit quietly for a minute or two. This is from Zen Master Dogen. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things.